Approach March. To enable the reader to make proper sense of the rest of the book, a brief sketch is needed of the staff network in which the escape services worked. Thanks to the age-old tradition that capture meant disgrace, no official encouragement or support for escape was provided by any general staff until well on into the 1914-18 war. By 1917, British intelligence chiefs had realised that prisoners of war, both friend and foe, constituted valuable sources for them, hitherto untapped. In that year, a small new sub-branch of the War Office Intelligence Directorate was set up, called MIIA, to look into this and, in particular, to secure from German prisoners in camps in the United Kingdom specialised knowledge which they had not revealed at their primary interrogation in France. MIIA was to handle also anything that could be secured from British prisoners in Germany. It set about organising secret communication with officer camps by coded letter. No startling results were obtained, but enough was done to suggest that the still rudimentary system might be worth following up, should the war to end wars turn out to have failed in that object. For most of the 1920s, few British or American civilians thought another great war at all likely. Even in the service departments in Whitehall, up to 1933, none was expected for 10 years at least, and the subject of prisoners of war slumbered. On the continent of Europe, there was slightly more interest. The French instituted in 1926 a retrospective award, an escaper's medal for successful or even well-attempted escapes from Germany. One French general, P.G. Dupont, a corps commander at Verdun, had had an enterprising idea. He had trained his men to be ready, if they fell into enemy hands, not only to seize any chance they could to escape, but also to look out for every possible opportunity to commit sabotage, notably when out on working parties in farms or factories. General von Brauchitz, later German commander-in-chief in the West, lectured on Dupont's idea at Munich in 1937, when the Germans were getting ready for the next round. His lecture text reached England and was studied with interest at the War Office. By the autumn of the following year, war was visibly nearer. In November 1938, a few weeks after the Munich Agreement, two staff officers in separate branches of the War Office began to work quite independently and unknown to each other towards the same end, the recreating of some such body as the old MIIA, modernised to suit the current forms and phases of war. One of them had served in the original branch, the other, from a less conventional career, had secured a more influential post. A.R. Rawlinson, the father of a future Tory solicitor general, had been a young intelligence officer, I.O., in MIIA in 1917-18, and therefore had some experience in the problems of reinterrogating prisoners and of promoting escape and evasion. As a reserve officer, he had been called up for a few months' service after the Munich crisis and was remobilised in August 1939 into a revived MIIA as a captain, a GSO3 on the War Office's establishment. This book has to be crammed with ranks. In a military history, it is necessary to show who was senior to whom. Readers in a less rank-sodden age need not count this a fault. The other was J.C.F. Holland, the lonely originator of the Commandos, as well as the Deception Services and the Special Operations Executive, SOE. He was an unusually modest and self-effacing member of a traditionally self-effacing caste, a regular officer from the Celtic fringe, with Indian civil service, clerical and academic forebears. Too ill to take up a regimental command in the Royal Engineers when at last due for one late in 1938, he was posted as a major to GSR, a tiny research branch of the War Office. The only other member of it was his typist, and told to research on any subject he chose. His predecessor had worked on army education. Holland, having won a DFC as a pilot and worked with Lawrence in Arabia, chose irregular warfare, a subject on which his mind had preyed continuously since 1917, all the more keenly after he had fought in the British Army on the losing side and been badly wounded in the Troubles of 1919-21 in Ireland. According to his friend and colleague, Joan Bright Astley, he had an independent mind, an acute brain, a loving and poetic heart. He was quick, imaginative, and of a fiery temper. During the winter of 1938-9, irregular warfare became a subject topical enough to engage the interest of the chiefs of staff. Holland's branch was renamed MIR, and he brought in a friend to join him, Major, later Major General, Sir Colin Gubbins, who became a leading personality in the SOE. Gubbins was a gunner. He and Holland had been officer cadets together. Holland's lively mind continued to play over the possibilities of work on and over the borders of normal fighting, while Gubbins prepared a series of pamphlets destined to be widely distributed during the impending World War on sabotage, ambush, and other guerrilla activity. Holland and Gubbins were each the son of a Don who had served in the East and been a protege of Lord Curzon's. Both were original thinkers, who yet kept their originality within the bounds of common sense and practicability. Both foresaw that there might be hundreds of thousands of prisoners in the next war, each of whom might be turned into a small thorn in the enemy's side, and that there might well be hundreds or even thousands of evaders as well, loose in the enemy's rear areas and in need of guidance. Who was to be their guide? Rawlinson's superior in MI1A, then a brevet lieutenant colonel, a future DMI, later Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templer, was posted to the expeditionary force in France at the beginning of the war, before Rawlinson had had time to do more than formulate some outline plans, and while Holland had much else beside escaping on his mind. Templer's initiative, possibly stemming in turn from a hint from Holland, with whom and Gubbins he had discussed the subject already, brought it to the point of decision. On the 28th of September 1939, with the full agreement of Major General Sir Noel Mason Macfarlane, his superior in France, Templer wrote to Major General Beaumont Nesbitt, the Director of Military Intelligence, to propose pre-arrangement of code communications with German camps. About the very day on which he received Templer's letter, Beaumont Nesbitt was called on by M.C.C. Harrison, one of the authors of Within Four Walls. Harrison followed up his call with a long letter on the value of an inter-service department to help prisoners of war to escape by providing them secretly with maps, compasses, and money. Holland was called in to advise, and on the 13th of October put up a substantial paper on the very thorough organisation that was going to be needed. Among the advantages he foresaw was the siphoning off of enemy manpower into non-productive channels. He observed that the Admiralty and the Air Ministry would also, of course, be involved, and his paper was accordingly referred to the Joint Intelligence Committee. That committee's papers are still unavailable to public inspection, but it undoubtedly approved Holland's paper in principle. A short, sharp exchange of letters followed between Beaumont Nesbitt and his opposite number at the Air Ministry, Air Commodore K.C. Buss, about which of the three services should form and control the new organisation. Beaumont Nesbitt was prepared to accept responsibility for Army and Navy prisoners, but thought that the RAF, with its superior knowledge of navigation, would need different training and treatment. Buss felt strongly that the interests of all three services would best be served by a single organisation under the War Office, with liaison officers from the Navy and the Air Force. He was thinking solely in terms of the previous Great War, in which Army prisoners had far outnumbered Air Force ones, and did not foresee the problems that would soon be posed by evaders. Buss won the day, a victory which the Air Ministry later came to regret, and made a strenuous effort to reverse. The JIC seems to have recommended that the new body should come under an escaper from the previous World War, and Holland put up several names. He argued, nevertheless, that any former escaper was bound to be too much prejudiced by his own experiences. He was sure that a strong man without bias was needed who could display the energy and drive of a leader as he controlled and coordinated the team of experts working under him.